I remember one year, my dad leased a big farm in the county. And one night we parked the equipment, all the tractors and everything were parked together. We went home that night. When we came back the next morning, we had the tractors were shot up, the windows were busted out. And so that act of vandalism, in which we saw other people riding up and down the road, and we kind of had an idea who that might have been. But we knew we weren't welcomed in that town and that farm community then.
This interview is with Philip Johnson, P.J. Haney III, a fifth-generation farmer from Reedville in Northumberland County. I interviewed P.J. in April of 2021 as he was planting his crop in Arkansas. He was gracious enough to talk to me while in the cab of his tractor, so there is some mechanical feedback in this phone interview.
My name is Philip Johnson Haney III. I go by PJ. My grandfather was Philip. My father was Philip. And my son is Philip. I am from Reedville, Virginia, Northumberland County. I am a farmer. I strive to feed, clothe, and fuel consumers every day with the commodities that we grow on our farm. I have had the pleasure of working with my father the majority of my life after I graduated from high school, college, where I studied agricultural economics, and I returned home to my family farming business. I had the pleasure of meeting other Black farmers from across the country, and some of the recognitions I've received have been America's Best Young Farmer and Rancher. I was the face for the Thank America's Farmers campaign, a national ad campaign, and more recently have the opportunity to participate in an upcoming TV show here with National Geographic, Aaron Memorial Day, talking about what we do farm. I appreciate that. Appreciate you having me here today.
Thank you. What year were you born?
I was born in 1977.
And you attended school in Reedville? What schools did you attend?
Well, I actually attended elementary school in Reedville, right there, Northumberland Elementary School, right beside Shiloh Baptist Church in Reedville, to Northumberland Middle School, and I graduated from Northumberland High School in 1995.
What college you graduated from?
I graduated from Virginia Tech. I graduated from Virginia Tech in the spring of 1999 with a degree in agriculture and applied economics. My concentration was in marketing and management, so I desired to go to school to learn how to better run and manage the farming operation from the business side of it. Things I learned were accounting and finance and management, all applied to marketing, all applied to agriculture. So that's what I studied in college.
So what was your first job, your first paying job that you had?
Well, it was working on the farm. It was a Friday one day, and Dad was paying all the rest of the guys. And, hey, Dad, what about me? He said, hey, son, let me ask you a question. You were at home last night, and you went in the refrigerator. Was it empty, or was it food in there? I said, oh, it was food in there. When you laid in the bed that night, did you look up at a ceiling, or did you look up at the stars? So I looked up at the ceiling. So, well, believe it or not, son, you were paid. And I learned that because I was part of the family, I had to put a lot of sweat equity in. And as I got older and my responsibilities improved, and, you know, there was time on the farm there were funds available in those years, where I could work. Dad made me save my money to buy. He split my first vehicle cost with me. I wanted these nice fancy tennis shoes when I was in high school, like my friends, and I had to work, turning my hours on the farm just like the rest of the employees did to earn that money. So the farm was my first paying job. I appreciate it.
You were saying you are a fourth generation farmer?
I am a fifth generation farmer.
You are a fifth generation Black farmer. So tell me a little bit about the first Philip Haney, or the first Haney.
Well, my great-great-grandfather, Reverend Robert Haney, he was the first African-American to purchase land in Northumberland County. He purchased 60 acres of land on September the 14th, 1867, and my family still currently owns and farms that land today. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, they all farmed and diversified the operation. However, it was my father that really escalated the size of our operation when he returned from college, and he and my grandfather started raising pigs and expanded from pig production into more row crop production. We currently farm across all four counties of the Northern Neck, Northumberland County being our home county, Lancaster County, Richmond, and Westmoreland County. We've had the pleasure of expanding our operation. I'm currently on our farm in Arkansas. So we expanded down to the Delta. And, we are farming acres down here as well.
And while you're talking to me, you're actually planting beans, right? You're actually
yes,
in
ma'am.
Your tractor.
I'm on the tractor right now planting soybeans while I'm talking to you. It's planting season. The soil temperature has warmed up, and we try to time our planting so after the last frost, soil temperatures start to warm up, so the crop will germinate, get out of the ground, and our growing season is between now and the first killing frost in the fall. So we have to get our crop in a timely manner, and that's what we're doing. At home, my dad's getting started planting corn and soybeans there, so we're planting in two states at the same time.
You all decided to extend into Arkansas. How did that come about?
Well, I was contacted by a gentleman in 2006, asked if I would come to meet other black farmers to serve on a black farmer advisor group. Now, Pixie, at the time, I had graduated from college, been in agriculture all my life, and if you had asked me to name you another black farmer that was farming over 1,000 acres to over 1,500 acres, I wasn't able to do it. So I went to this meeting and met other black farmers from around the country, and I realized that I wasn't out here all alone by myself. And some of the same challenges I was having, they were having. You know, I couldn't go up to my local white neighbor and just say, hey, what are you paying for your tractor? I'm trying to get a quote on mine. What are you paying for fertilizer? These individuals were my competition and weren't openly sharing information as they were their white neighbor farmers. So I was introduced to a whole new network of farmers who looked like me, who went through some of the same struggles that I had, and they're still third, fourth, and fifth generation farmers like I am. So after knowing these farmers and learning about different black farmers from around the country, and one of the other good friends of mine, who's a black farmer, we decided to tag team and lease some land down south. Thought we had the idea of planting. I had the idea of planting down south several weeks before we planted at home in Virginia, and could kind of spread the cost of some of this equipment over more acreage. You see, I have a corn planter that pretty much plants corn. We use it 1 month out of the year, and it sits in the shed for the other 11 months. And my thought was that we could plant a crop down south and then move it back home and plant a crop at home. And that was the initial thought for expanding and trying to spread out. With all the water that we have around us in Virginia, we don't have any irrigation. It's all salt water. So we're not irrigating any of our fields that we have on the Northern Neck. And that was another reason. Down in the Delta, there's a lot of irrigation. It's more of a common practice than at home. That allows us to be able to consistently produce consistent yields on our crop. That was the reason for that.
Do you plan to expand more? I mean, you have.
I would like to. Mm-hmm. I would like to. There is opportunity to grow down here. The one county I farm in down here in the Delta is probably as large as three counties on the Northern Neck that we farm in. So there's a lot. Land is a lot more vast. Irrigation is a lot more prominent, and there are a lot of farmers in this area that are retiring, and land is more available. And that's not the case where we farm back home.
It may have been maybe 10, 15 years ago, you please correct me if I'm wrong, where black farmers were being denied grants, and they were giving out like seeds that were free to the farmers. Is that something that actually occurred?
I know it was about 20 years ago when I was in college where black farmers were protesting the government for discriminatory lending practice. Black farmer protests were going on around the country, mostly in Washington, and black farmers were rallying together to the USDA to show that there was not equal and fair access to loans. And USDA did an investigation and showed that on average, it took 30 days to approve a white farmer's loan, but on average 120 days to approve a black farmer's loan. And because of that disparity, they settled a class action lawsuit with black farmers from around the country. That happened during my time in college and after I graduated. So it was more so in the lending practices. There really weren't grants available to farmers. They were loans, low interest loans through the Department of Agriculture for buying equipment, seed, fertilizer, land. That's where the disparity was in the lending practice.
Your father was very instrumental in getting the black farmers from the Northern Neck as having some type of representation to make sure that their voices were heard. Is that correct?
Yes, he was. He was very instrumental in the late 90s, in the mid to late 90s, in the plight of the black farmer. He testified before Congress. Dad was featured in an article in the Washington Post magazine back in 2004 called The Promised Land. You Google Philip Haney, The Promised Land, it'll take you to the archives of the Washington Post. At the time, Will Haygood, who's the author of the book, The Butler, that turned into a movie, he was a writer for the Washington Post. He did a story about Dad and talked about the plight of black farmers. And even today, it's a very powerful tool and helps tell them the story on how black farmers just diminished. Depicted in 1920, there were 1 million black farmers across the country compared to 4 million white farmers, so a 1-to-4 ratio. However, in 1996, there were less than 15,000 black farmers around the country and over 1 million white farmers, and that's over 100-to-1 ratio. And it's not because it rained on the white farmer side of the road and it didn't rain on the black farmer side of the road. It's because a systematic structure that denied African-Americans land, loans, for accessing land and operating funds. See, farming is a very capital intense business. We borrow in the spring and plant our crops and pay back in the fall when we harvest. And if I come in to apply for that loan in February and have aspirations to get that loan within 30 days to plant my crop, and I don't get those proceeds till June or July, I've missed my planting window. And you know, it was proven that took place around the country, kind of like domino effects. U.S. Department of Agriculture has a presence in every county throughout every state across the country. That local county office is responsible for issuing loans to farmers to plant their crops. And those local county offices were often controlled by what we know as the good old boys. These county offices were responsible for lending loans to farmers for buying livestock, purchasing feed, fertilizer, land, and it was very critical that farmers get those loans in time. And when farmers weren't able to get those loans, that's when the trouble came.
And this was occurring not only on the Northern Neck, but just across the board for black farmers everywhere?
Exactly. Once the U.S. Department of Agriculture did that investigation, they found that this didn't only happen in certain states, it happened across the country. It was almost like a domino effect. And when farmers didn't get those loans in time to plant in time, and they were delayed, and they didn't get their crop didn't yield to what their neighbor's crop yielded beside them because the neighbors were able to get funds to plant early, those local county offices foreclosed on those farmers. And it was pretty much a system that was set up to fail. You can't plant on time at the ideal time when it comes to planting. You miss out on your window. So corn typically is planted in the Virginia in that April and May timeframe. But if you don't plant that corn till June or July, your corn is pollinating during the hot dog days of August. It doesn't get enough growing degree units to perform. Whereas your neighbor's corn is yielding 150 to 175 bushels and you're only yielding 100, you can't cash flow as your neighbor can. Therefore, you've got an economic knee on your neck by not being able to pay your bills. Therefore, you don't have the luxury of being able to cash flow. And when you can't cash flow, those farmers were foreclosed on.
And that's how some of those black farmers were losing their land. And were the white farmers or someone else appropriating those farms for themselves? Were they being swallowed up, so to speak?
Well, it did show that a lot of white farmers who sat on those same county committees that were aware of what's going on They were the ones that ended up with some of the land that the black farmers were farming or were losing.
Some of the practices where they were trying to prevent black farmers from producing, do you think some of those practices are still being used?
Oh, yes. That's definitely the case. You know, back on the height of the black farmer protest, it was discovered that the civil rights arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture was disembarked under the Reagan administration. So at the time, if you were my local USDA county office where I had to go in to apply for loans and report my crop acreage, if I had a complaint against that local county office, I had to turn it in at the county office. Well, we know that a lot of those complaints never made it out of the trash can in that office once those farmers turned in those complaints. The second thing is the ones that did go to Washington, they sat in an empty warehouse because there was no agency within the Department of Agriculture to address that. So we're fortunate now that we do have a civil rights arm at the U.S. Department of Agriculture that can address issues that come up. There is someone that will listen to our cry if needed. But the problem is a lot of black farmers have gone on. You know, there's so many young men and women that saw the struggles that granddaddy and daddy had and daddy and mama were struggling, and they didn't encourage or incentivize them to come into that same struggle. They encouraged them to go off the farm and get a job and help provide a subsistence income for their family. And oftentimes we look at it and I think that was a genocide of blacks in agriculture, because if I saw it tough on you, I didn't want to pursue the same. I thought that we needed to go in another, people thought that they needed to go in another direction. But if there was opportunity, just like our neighbors, we could have bought land 30 years. My grandfather and father could have bought land 30 and 40 years ago, just like some of our white neighbors did. Therefore, today we could own the vaster amounts of land that some of our neighbors own. And therefore, the wealth that our family would have created by buying land and working that land over the years would be greater than what it is now. You know, generational wealth is what we try to establish and pass on in the farm community. And typically that's done with land. You know, farmers don't typically invest in stocks and things they can't see and touch. They buy land, they buy equipment, and they know how to use the two to provide something for their families. And once that land is paid for, that land is left for the generations to come. But we're multiple, how should I say this, black farmers have not been able to acquire land to the size and the amounts that our neighbors have because we had not had access to fair lending and loans in the past. So you don't find the number of acres owned by black farmers anywhere close to the number of acres owned by white farmers.
You all have land in Westmoreland and Richmond County? Because you were saying you count all the counties in the northern neck, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a crew for the Westmoreland, Richmond County, or you and your dad, y'all kind of overseeing on those other two?
So we oversee it. We have a crew of men that work with us, but we oversee that, and we use the same crew for all four counties. So it's not like we have a crew just for Richmond County or Westmoreland. I mean, we move combines from Reedville all the way to Montrose, all the way to Red Hill, all the way to Irvington. So we move equipment as we're harvesting in that loop.
Are your crews integrated?
Yes. Yes, they are. And just so recently, we have some international labor in which we have an H2A program, and we have international workers coming for us. We have white South African workers actually on our farm today driving some of our equipment.
Any women?
We've had women truck drivers in the past, no farm operators. We have women in the office, but out in the field, currently, no, we don't.
What is your earliest memory of racism as you was living on the northern neck?
I remember one year, my dad leased a big farm in the county, and one night we parked the equipment, all the tractors and everything were parked together. We went home that night. When we came back the next morning, we had the tractors were shot up, the windows were busted out. And so that act of vandalism, in which we saw other people riding up and down the road, and we kind of had an idea who that might have been. But we knew we weren't welcomed in that town and that farm community then. And it just really put a fire in my belly to make sure that I earned my welcome. I stayed there, and we continued to do a good job of farming and planting our crops on time and harvesting. And that's one of my early recollections. And I was there with my dad, and then we just witnessed that together, and I'll never forget it. Another sign was my dad would take me everywhere with him, to the bank, to the co-op where he's buying seed or chemicals. And I remember coming out of the bank one time, and he just sat in the truck, and he was just shaking his head, and he was upset. What's wrong? Tough being a black man in farming, son. A lot of white folks don't want us to be in this business. They don't like the fact that we bought land. And I remember telling him, I said, well, you know, when I grow up, it's going to be different. He looked over, he said, why is that? I said, well, you know, when you went to school, it was segregation, and there was, you know, black kids and white kids didn't go to school together. But for me, it's different. You see, I play soccer with white kids and basketball with first kids, so it's different. And he laughed and chuckled, and he said, son, just keep on living. And I remember that to this day, because you see the disparities now more so from an economic perspective. You know, when it's buy a piece of land or do something, you know, that gets noticed more so than anything else. But I would say that would probably be my earliest recollection at that time. We had our equipment. Even also on our farm, we had our buildings set on fire, and we lost hogs and equipment in a shed that we believe was intentionally set on fire. Those are memories that I have from a very young age that just still stick with me today.
My father is a waterman, and you always could tell, you know, by the moon and by the leaves. Do y'all still go by, I know you have the latest technology, but do you still have some of the old ways of how your great-great-grandfather planted?
We do go by that as a gauge. Granddaddy would always say, when the leaves on a poplar tree get big as a squirrel's ear, it's time to plant corn. And it's funny, because I still look at those poplar trees in the spring of the year, see when it warms up. We try to go off of more technical information, like growing degree units, soil temperature, and things like that. I find myself taking a meat thermometer and sticking it in the ground and see what the soil temperature is to determine if it's warm enough to plant corn in the spring of the year. But we do look at those things. You know, Granddad would always say, if you go outside and you look up at night, you don't see any stars, it's a chance of rain because the cloud cover is above you. You know, those omens that the older farmers live by. You know, nowadays I can pick up my phone and look at a lot of the forecast models, predictions on weather, temperature, those type of things. So we use a combination of what worked in the past, also what we have available to us in present day.
The technology that is afforded to you in this day and time, he is embracing this new technology, and he's using it?
Yes, some of it. More fully adapting to it. You know, when I first came out of college, we were shifting to a whole new platform of automation in the equipment on the farm. For example, this tractor I'm driving right now as I'm talking to you, it's driving itself down the field. It has a GPS receiver on the roof that's guiding it longitude and latitude down the field. So, you know, before we had markers, and Granddaddy used to lay off the field and he'd pick out a tree or a telephone or pole or something on the other end and try to drive a straight road to that end of the field. And I grew up with that same technology, and Dad used to lay off fields for me till I could kind of hold a straight row. But then when I came out of college in the 90s, while I was in college in the 90s, we started seeing a lot of auto steer options on equipment. So instead of you running that marker all day, and then as it gets dark, you have to stop because you can't see your mark. Now the tractors are GPS guided, so them drives themselves down the field just as accurate at midnight as they are midday planting. The technology has really brought a lot of automation down. One thing Dad and I currently use, and he just called me on it yesterday, I use a weather app on my phone that determines how much rain we had across our footprint. Each one of our farms, it tracks the rainfall. So if I were home before this technology was available, Dad would ride two counties and see if it's dry enough to work, and I'd ride the other two and say, hey, I think we can work over here. Now I can just look at the app on that phone to see how much rainfall we had in Lancaster or Northumberland, see that's the area we need to go check, instead of spending 3 or 4 hours riding around the different farms seeing if it's dry enough to work.
Was there ever a time that you thought that you weren't going to still be a farmer like your family? Was there ever a time when you thought about doing something different?
There was. I had the privilege of working an internship while I was in college. And I drove out to Nebraska and worked for a big ag company on their commodity trading floor. And granted, it was nice that summer to sit in an air-conditioned building and behind a desk versus out in the field, that hot sun breathing down my neck. But every time I got a chance to get out of that office and see equipment up and down the road and in the field, It reminded me of where I really wanted to be. That particular summer, my father had one of his main men to take sick, and he didn't have a combine driver. And I knew that my family was more important than taking care of and providing for my family was more important than that opportunity I had with that job. So I told my supervisor that my family needed me, had to go back home. I left Nebraska on a straight drive through back to Virginia, surprised my dad to show up for work, spent a couple of days, and that answered my calling right there.
You are listening to A Pixie from Kilmarnock with an interview with fifth-generation farmer P.J. Haney of Reedville, Virginia, while he was planting soybeans in Arkansas. P.J. has faced the struggles and challenges not only as a farmer, but as a black farmer with conviction and courage to feed the citizens of this nation. He is an advocate for black farmers' struggles with inequality, discrimination, and illegal policies levied upon the black farmer nationwide. When you attended school, schools had already been integrated?
Schools were integrated when I attended, when I graduated. My father, I think when he was at Central, I think that was the first. It integrated back during my father's time, but schools were integrated during my time in elementary school, middle school, and high school.
Were there any particular teachers that motivated you or they put a specific interest in you?
I had the pleasure of being taught by my grandmother, Gladys Thompson Haney. She unfortunately was killed in a car accident, and I was in her class at the time. I was in seventh grade. I had another teacher, Lillian Brinkley, and a lot of people in Northumberland County may have had Miss Brinkley. She reminded me one day in class that she corrected me. Said, "I correct your daddy and I correct you too." So old school teachers like that just make you think about and make you appreciate them because they saw what was in you and they saw the understanding of your family, the values that they know that your family wanted for you. And the expectations that your family had, and they would kind of help hold you accountable for that. You know, how are you going to go to college with grades like this, son? How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? So I was very fortunate for the upbringing. You know, the old African cliche says it takes a village to raise a child. And that is very true because I'm fortunate for the village that was surrounded me in Northumberland County. You know, family, friends, aunties, great aunts, cousins, they all, you know, were able to see and make sure that they help to watch over you, lead you, and point you in the right direction.
When you were growing up, what were some of the places that you used to go to, you know, hang out?
Well, Dad didn't let me hang out too much. It was more so go to the field. You know, Friday night after a football game, I would hang out with my friends a little bit, but mostly I worked a lot. You know, Pixie, by the time I was 15 years old, I was able to replace a 50-year-old hired hand on the farm. And not really replace, but I was able to do everything that hired worker could do. Drive tractors, combines, sprayers, tractor trailers. So I was, at 15, I was my dad's best skilled and cheapest labor, okay?
What are some of the memories of fun that you have growing up?
Well, I was active in sports. I was captain of my high school football team and played basketball. I had friends that I would hang out with, but I knew during planting and harvest season what the commitment that I had to give to my family. So, you know, it was just, I enjoyed hanging out with my dad. He and I would spend a lot of time together and working. You know, it was a way of life, but it was fun to spend all that time with him. You know, from the time I was five, Dad took me everywhere with him. He had a meeting, I'd go with him. We're in the pickup truck together. We're on the tractor together, sat in his lap and begged him to drive. You know, he taught me a lot of things early on. So those were probably some of my most fondest memories. I did play sports and friends and things like that. But the time I spent with Dad is probably my most memorable.
What are some of the foods that is indicative to the Northern Neck that you love and you miss?
Well, I still love my blue crabs at home in Virginia. It's Down in the Delta, people are crazy about these crawfish, but they're nowhere nothing like a Chesapeake Bay blue crab. The oysters, the fish, the seafood is just one treasure at home that I can't find anywhere else in the country. You know, it's funny, you go other places that are landlocked. If you're in the Midwest or somewhere and people want to offer you seafood, I say, well, you know, it's probably got to be flown or trucked in here versus picking it up fresh off the dock like we do at home. So I'll pass on the seafood, but I would say that's one of the treasures that I enjoy at home, steaming my own crabs and cooking my own fresh seafood. That's what I enjoy most.
I'm about to go home so I can find some shad fish because they're running.
Yes.
What person motivated you the most as you was growing up?
My father was a major inspiration in my life. Still is today. We talk every day. But I'm here, or if I'm at home, you know, I had other people that were role models, but my father was the biggest role model and inspired me more than anyone else.
Just what differences would you like to see in the Northern Neck?
I think I'd like to see more equity across all platforms, you know, regardless of the industry. You know, you mentioned your family being watermen, and, you know, I think it would be good to see equal participation in all aspects of the businesses in the Northern Neck, you know, whether it's, you know, fish boat, you know, more black fish boat captains, you know, more black pilots for the spotter plane, for the spotter pilots for the fish factory, more black business owners. I think we need to see more diversity in ownership of businesses, things like that.
What advice would you give to the young people that's living on the Northern Neck?
Well, a lot of young people in our community often overlook agriculture. And I would tell them that, you know, 25% of all the jobs in the world are agriculture related, food, fiber, and fuel. So granted, I'm raising corn and I sell that corn to Purdue possibly, and you buy Purdue chicken in the grocery store. You don't see Haney Farms on that bag, but what we do right at home helps to supply and feed consumers around the world. Also, the corn that we raise and we sell to ethanol plants. That corn is used for ethanol, so the ethanol is in your gas, E85 at the gas pump. And that ethanol helps to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. And also, there's down here in the Delta, the cotton. Cotton is grown for clothing that you wear. So agriculture is for food, fiber, food, fuel, and fiber. And I just would like to make sure I encourage men and women in our community to realize that exists, to realize that the opportunities in agriculture and the careers that people have in agriculture. You know, you don't have to go into agriculture because you want to be a farmer, but there are more soil scientists and people working in agriculture and sales and marketing that don't necessarily farm. And I think if a lot of young men and women were exposed and knew about that, they could look for opportunities in the field of agriculture right where they are. And that's the one thing that I would share.
What do you think about the future of hemp cultivation?
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunity going to be in hemp. It's so new right now. We haven't tried any. You know, just reading up on a lot of people who grow hemp and the market for it and trying to find a buyer. And you go out and plant all this, and then when it's time to harvest, you know, you don't have anyone to buy it or your price is cut. It's so new. There's a lot of unknowns for us. We know what to do with corn and soybeans, wheat, and those commodities that we've raised over the years. That's where we're kind of focusing our efforts on what's worked for us in the past.
But you're not going to not, if more information is available, is something that you will consider?
Definitely.
Yeah, expanding your product line?
Yes, ma'am.
Your son is going to follow your footsteps, to your family's footsteps?
I don't know. I have three children. I have a daughter who's a freshman at North Carolina A&T. I have a son, a senior in high school. He'll be graduating next weekend.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Looking at HBCUs. My daughter wants to study biology, wants to go into the medical field. You know, my oldest son, he wants to study political science. My youngest son wants to be a veterinarian. And I want to make sure I expose them to all the facets of agriculture, you know, all the opportunities that exist in agriculture. So they know that they have a choice if they want to come back to their family business, if they want to do something else in agriculture, or else they want to pursue other careers. I just want to make sure they know that this is available and here for them if they want to, and help them if they want to get into it. And if they don't, I want to support them. But the one thing I've always told them, and my dad shares with them as well, along with my sisters and the rest of my family, is the importance of land ownership. The good Lord's not making any more land. When you own land, you own a piece of something, that, you know, that's what I want to make sure I carry on to my children. They understand that if something happened to me and, you know, even though they don't want to farm, what do they do with this land? They know their options. They know they can lease it out to other farmers. They know they can have recreational activities on it for fishing and hunting. And so I want to make sure they are aware of the opportunities with land if they don't want to farm. And if they do want to farm, that's amazing. I'm here to support them and help them and get them started in that if they do.
Do you see your brand extending a hand not only within the borders of the United States, but worldwide to teach?
I do. Dad and I are looking at some opportunities where we can produce something that we can ship to other countries and feed children in other worlds, in other countries across the world. We're looking at ways that we can help create a teaching platform to showcase agriculture to others. I have the privilege of serving as chairman of the National Black Growers Council, an organization whose mission is to improve the efficiency, productivity, and sustainability of black row crop farmers. One of the signature events that we have is what we call our Model Farm Series Field Days, in which we host a field day and bring the black farm and non-farm community out to showcase the latest and greatest that agriculture has to offer on a black farmer's property. And this has been a real success in helping us to help other individuals understand why we produce the crops that we do and what the use for them is. You know, a lot of people are really not really aware of the commodity aspect. You know, everyone says, oh, you grow corn. I like to buy your corn. I said, well, I'm not a sweet corn farm. So I don't grow sweet corn where it's something that you can buy and put on your dinner table. I raise feed grain corn. And if you're in the feed business or you want to grind corn to feed chickens or hogs or cattle or make ethanol with it, yeah, I have something to sell you. So a lot of people, just to help educate our community on what we do, what we have available. So that's a big proponent there, Dixie.
Sound like the Haney Farms got it going on.
We're fortunate that we can continue. I'm fortunate that I can continue my family legacy in farming. I'm fortunate that I'm blessed with the opportunity to go to work every day with my dad and continue to work with my sisters and our family business. I have four sisters. And they all have different careers, medicine, physical therapist, accountant, but they all are participating in the family business in some aspect. You know, my sister that's a doctor lives out of state. She comes in, hey, you got any parts you need me to pick up for you at John Deere today when I come through? You know, everybody helps and knows that, you know, it's time sensitive of the work that we do. And everyone wants to help participate and do what they can to make sure they support the business. So.
If you could speak to the President of the United States or to the Secretary of Agriculture, what would you say to them?
Well, I would thank them for all that they've done here recently to help recognize the inequities that exist in agriculture. I've had several conversations with Secretary Vilsack and the new administration and talking about how do we address these inequities that exist, finding ways to create opportunity to help protect and ensure the stability and sustainability of the existing black farmers, and put programs in place to help incentivize and encourage other African Americans to get into the business of farming. I think that's something that I would be willing to help do to make sure we continue to sustain diversity in production agriculture.
Well, I know you're busy. I so appreciate that you taking the time out. I hope that I'll be allowed to call you back, you know, for any kind of follow-up and also just to see what you're up to. And I want to thank you. Everybody's busy living life. Living life.
Yes, ma'am. And we're busy trying to feed you right now. So
yeah, I'm going
to
let you go.
I'm going to get these soybeans planted, okay?
Okay. Thank you so much, PJ. And
thank you. Have an awesome day.
You too. Bye now. You be careful. NPR reports that there has been a 95% decrease of black farmers nationwide per census information from 1920 to 2017 because of discrimination leading to the loss of land due to systemic racism, of procuring loans to pay off debts, struggles to maintain a continuous source of revenue, and maintaining a standard of living. Search NPR.org for the August 4th, 2021 segment entitled Black Missouri Farmer. We are a rapidly dying species. PBS NewsHour stories have highlighted the discrimination that continues in loan approval practices, the appropriation of land due to the inability to keep up loan payments, the continued denial of fair access to loans to pay off debts and to keep a yielding crop revenue as a source of livelihood for black farmers. Search pbs.org/newshour/show for the series Race Matters that aired on December the 7th, 2021. The segment title is Historically Denied Pivotal Loans, Black Farmers Still Struggle to Get Support. For more insight on the loss of land of black farmers, watch A Piece of the Delta, produced by The Atlantic on YouTube. Search How Black Americans Were Robbed of Their Lands. For more stories on the illegal practices perpetrated on black farmers, go to The Atlantic's website, theatlantic.com, and search for Van, that's with two N's, R. Newkirk II, a senior editor at The Atlantic and the host of the podcast Floodlines. There are necessary changes needed to highlight the plight of black farmers and support them by exposing the years-long practice of discrimination and racism in yet another aspect of being black, particularly being black on the Northern Neck. Thank you, Travis Polk, and thank you, Mason Mills. And a special thank you to Sean Evans, whose support is invaluable. The music by Robert A. Hall. Watch Meet the Haney Family, Seeking Equity and Education in Farming, produced and featured on Indigo Ag on their blog. That's indigoag.com/blog. For more on the Haney Farms, go to their website, haneyfarms.com, and follow PJ on Instagram. This first program is in memory of my parents, James C. and Shirley M. Hill Curry, and sister, Angela Diana Curry. Thank you for listening.